Support for this show comes from Slack. You're a growing business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Hey, it's Sean Ehling, host of The Gray Area. Before we get started with today's show, which I promise you is a real banger, I need to ask for a moment of your time to take our brand new survey. If you have a few minutes, we would appreciate you going to vox.com/podcast survey and answering some questions so that we can continue bringing you the stuff you want to hear. That's vox.com/podcast survey. And the link is also in the show notes. It really helps us out. Thanks. There's an old platitude. We live in extraordinary times. You've heard it, maybe even said it yourself, when you heard about gene editing technology, or the melting of the Antarctic ice sheet, or when the vending machine candy bar you bought knocked loose a bag of chips on its way down, and you got two treats for the price of one. And that's the problem with saying things like this. It depends on how you define what's ordinary. I think a better question to ask might be, do we live in revolutionary times? I think the answer to that is yes. What makes this moment revolutionary, if it is revolutionary, is the disorienting pace of societal and technological change, and all the turbulence that comes with that. So where does that leave us? Should we be hopeful? Terrified? And what can we learn from history about what's going to happen next? I'm Sean Ehling, and this is The Gray Area. Today's guest is Fareed Zakaria. He's been thinking about these questions for a long time as a political scientist and writer. You might know him as the host of CNN's GPS and a columnist at the Washington Post. He's got a new book called Age of Revolutions, Progress and Backlash from 1600 to the Present. The book is a sweeping history of four modern revolutions, starting with the Netherlands in the 16th century and ending with the present moment, which he argues is one of the most revolutionary ages in human history, even though it might not feel that way in real time. It's a compelling case, and one, frankly, that's been dancing around in my own head for years now. So I invited Fareed back onto the show to talk about it. Fareed Zakaria, welcome to The Gray Area.
Thank you so much, Sean. It was a pleasure the first time. Looking forward to this.
This book of yours, there's a lot of history packed into this thing, and we can't cover it all, but I do want to ask why you decided to start your historical clock in the Netherlands, of all places, in the 16th century.
So the book was animated by a desire to kind of understand, why are we going through what appears to be a kind of crazy revolutionary period in politics, you know, in the sense in which the Trump, Brexit, Bolsonaro in Brazil, you know, there's a sense in which the old categories of politics don't seem to be making sense and the system seems to be being upended at some level. The traditional parties in Europe, by and large, have collapsed. You know, if you look at France, the major left-wing party and the right-wing party are both doing terribly. And I thought, okay, so let me go back to periods where there has been similarly kind of revolutionary feeling, the feeling of politics being made new, the old order collapsing, a new one coming into being. But the more I researched, I realized that the Dutch had really invented modern politics. That before that, politics was basically about courts and kings and courtiers and, you know, vast agricultural economies. And then with the Dutch, you get the rise of the first merchant republic, a state that embraces capitalism, merit, some kind of more democratic political structure. And that is, after all, the world we live in now. The Dutch are the first to embrace modernity in that sense and innovation and take advantage of technological shifts like the invention of port ships and windmills and all that. And they become the richest country in the world. And so it felt like the Dutch was the right place to start because they're the ones who begin these series of revolutions that take place.
The French Revolution is always the case study example for revolutions that people go to. And I don't want to say that you think it's overrated, but is it fair to say that you don't think the French Revolution is as significant as many other people do?
The way I would put it is it's very significant as a failed revolution. It is not significant as a successful revolution.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
The revolutions that seem to have truly reshaped the world and reshaped the political and economic systems of society are the ones that were bottom-up. The French is an example of a top-down revolution. France did not go through a major economic revolution or technological revolution. It was a largely feudal, fairly backward, highly centralized country. And political elites, because of the utterly arbitrary nature of French monarchy and centralized rule, decide to revolt against it. And then they try top-down to put in place a whole series of very big transformations, democracy, the rights of man, getting rid of the church, none of which sticks, really. The anti-clerical part of it stuck, but mostly it all fails. I mean, the easiest way to tell the French Revolution failed is it ends up with Napoleon, a dictator, proclaiming himself emperor. The French Revolution was fundamentally about getting rid of the monarchy, right, and it ends with a more powerful monarchy than it had started with.
That is an important point, right? I mean, something you discuss in the book is this confusion over the definitions of the term revolution. So there's the common understanding of revolution as an event that overturns a political order. And then there's the original astronomical understanding of the term, which is, you know, a 360-degree movement around the sun. And the French Revolution is such a useful example of how very often revolutionaries think they're overturning a political system and imposing its opposite. But in reality, they end up replacing one regime with another that's functionally the same. Is that a common pattern in political revolutions?
Yeah, and it's a very interesting metaphoric or literary quality to this because there is this weird way in which the two meanings kind of merge sometimes. The more modern usage has always been this massive overthrowing of the old order. But if you think about some of the most famous revolutions, as you say, the French, even the Bolshevik Revolution, you could very easily argue that in effect, by the time you get to Stalin, you have simply replaced the Tsar's empire with a new empire. You think about the Iranian Revolution, you know, it overturns the Shah's tyranny and has replaced it with its own. In a softer sense, so many of the so-called revolutionaries of today, like Trump, who is constantly talking about how we need a revolution, we've got to break the system. But what he's really promising is a return to a kind of mythical 1950s America. So he too is, in a strange sense, revolutionary, but the revolution is to bring us back to where we once were.
Because we think of revolutions as primarily political events, it might surprise people to know that you called the Industrial Revolution the mother of all revolutions. Why is the Industrial Revolution so significant for you?
Because it really created the modern world. The Industrial Revolution takes human beings out of millennia of poverty, backwardness, disease, and turbocharges the growth standards of living, but also the idea that this is now a self-sustaining process where we'll always grow more. We now just expect that every year the economy will grow more than it has in the past. And that was a completely new phenomenon. And it happens because we are able to do something that was technologically thought impossible, which is to harness inanimate forms of energy. The Industrial Revolution is really an energy revolution. And all of that completely remakes society, because you go from a world of agriculture to a world of industry. People forget, but places like Harvard, to the extent they had trade elements, they were agricultural schools. Why? Because 95% of the people in America during the colonial era were engaged in agriculture. That transformation of society from an agricultural society to a modern industrial society happens because of the Industrial Revolution, and it completely overturns the politics of the age and much else.
The pace and scale of societal change seems to be crucial here, maybe the most important variable for me at least. And you even open the book with this great quote from Marx and Engels, of all people, where they're talking about how the soil is fertile for revolution because the world that people live in keeps getting upended and uprooted by capitalism. You know, all that is solid melts into air and all that. And this seems very correct to me. And it's not encouraging, Fareed, because the pace of change keeps accelerating.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is, you know, Marx and Engels, they were bad economists, but they were brilliant social scientists. And what they observed, and think about this, this is in the 1840s, they observed that the nature of capitalism was this constant progress or change, because it was constantly creating new things. And in that quote, if you read the entire thing, it comes from the Communist Manifesto. It says, capitalism, the bourgeois revolution, will inevitably create new wants and new needs. So even when you think you've made everything that you possibly could, you discover that, you know, you need new things, and that those new needs then drive the economy to new forms of dynamism and innovation. And as you say, all that is solid melts into air. And what he's talking about there is every belief system that you have is going to collapse because the underlying structure on which it was based has been changed by capitalism. And I quoted the end of the book, Walter Lippmann, the great political columnist and commentator, who writes in 1929 that the central problem of the age is that basically the acids of modernity are dissolving every belief system, all customs, all traditions. And the nature of modernity is that those acids will never let another belief system come into be or stay in place for long enough, because they will be dissolved. I mean, think about, we just thought we were finished with the software revolution, which had completely upended the economy. And now we have the AI revolution, which is going to upend whatever we thought we knew.
Do you think in the fullness of time, we might look back and say that the information revolution, the digital revolution, really, and all the change that that is creating, that that will end up being the most revolutionary period in human history in terms of how dramatically it changes human life and really human beings?
I suspect so, because I think what we are doing is even broader, even faster, and even more disruptive. So it's broader because the Industrial Revolution, as you know, basically takes place in a handful of countries clustered around the North Atlantic. This revolution, by its nature, is happening kind of everywhere. You go to India and you notice a country transformed by the smartphone. Poor farmers are now using it to transact business in a way that they never did, but are also consuming information and entertainment in a way that they never were. It's also happening faster. I mean, we all know those statistics of it took so many years for the first 100 million people to go online and then use Google, and then it took, I think, ChatGPT, you got to 100 million in 2 months. So everything is accelerating. But I think perhaps the most profound shift is yet to come, which is AI and gene engineering. Because so far, and I borrow this point from Yuval Noah Harari, who makes it very eloquently, for all of human history, the two things that never really changed were your fundamental mental capacities and your fundamental physical capacities. You know, human beings were as smart as they were. The brain didn't change that much over the last 20,000 years. And the human body didn't change that much. Now, what AI is doing is going to multiply the power of the human brain exponentially, because AI is getting to the point where it's soon going to be smarter than the smartest person in the world. It's going to become smarter than the combined intelligence of all the people in the world, because it's just going to keep growing exponentially. And then you're going to physically be able to create human beings who are much less prone to disease, who are much more capable of enhancing their physical capacities. You're talking about almost the creation of a Superman. There's clearly something very, very disruptive about this idea that you can actually change the fundamental mental and physical capacities of human beings.
Do you think the AI revolution and bioengineering and all that will, in the end, potentially be even more politically and culturally disruptive than the digital revolution was?
I think so. That's my gut. Again, you think about the speed and scale with which this is going to happen. How can it not have a political, social effect?
After a short break, we talk about how technological revolutions become political revolutions. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast comes from Constant Contact. If you're a business owner, you already know that it's really, really hard to cut through the noise of everyday life. If you want to connect with your customers, you need to break through the noise. You need Constant Contact. Constant Contact is a marketing platform that makes it easy to reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and connect over email, text, social media, and more. Whether you're a marketing guru or just learning the ropes, Constant Contact offers writing assistance tools and automation features that make it simple to say the right thing at the right time. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity. But giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else, and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
If we were doing some kind of comparative analysis, the only revolution you cover in the book that comes close to what we're living through now is the Industrial Revolution. Tell me about how that revolution transformed politics at the time, which was mostly around class lines, and how the digital revolution, the information revolution, is transforming politics today, because I suspect the differences matter.
The beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the right was opposed to the Industrial Revolution and the left was in favor of it, because the right in those days, classical conservatism, was basically rooted in the hierarchies of land, of blood, of religion. It was defending the aristocracy, the landed elite, the church, the monarchy, and all those things seemed to be as if they were going to be disrupted by industry, by the Industrial Revolution, which they were. The left, on the other hand, represented the merchants, the liberals, the people who were against monarchy, against established churches and their authority. But by the end of the Industrial Revolution, you get a kind of new politics. And the new politics is that the roles have flipped. The right is now in favor of industry, the Industrial Revolution, capitalism, because they realize it just created a new plutocratic elite, and the right was perfectly comfortable defending that new industrial elite. And the left realized that while it had been in favor of the kind of free markets, free trade, all that aspect of the Industrial Revolution, that it produces enormous inequality and immiseration for workers. The scale of that shift and the creation of that modern politics that endures for 150 years, you know, the left being the side that wants capitalism regulated, taxed, redistributed, and the right wanting minimal state intervention, that powerful framework is being upended. But will it be as powerful a transformation? I don't know. I mean, certainly the forces, the acids of modernity right now are as strong. But the reason I wonder is what we seem to be returning to is a kind of politics based on identity, culture, nationalism, national chauvinism, which means they tend to be kind of particular. In India, you're seeing the rise of Hindu nationalism. In Turkey, you're seeing the rise of a certain kind of Turkish nationalism fused with Islam. In Russia, you're seeing the rise of a kind of Orthodox Russian nationalism that sees Moscow as the third Rome. In China, you're seeing Han nationalism. So there is a common theme, but they are all going to manifest themselves quite differently. And I think you can't imagine quite the same common conversation or common allegiance that everyone will have to this one idea.
You mentioned identity, and you use the phrase identity revolution in the book, which is, you know, more about the sorts of human needs that become dominant once our basic material needs, food, water, shelter, that kind of thing, are met. But I do think these battles over identity are also what we should expect to happen when technology transforms how we relate to ourselves and each other and the world. It's just a lot of change very quickly. And I think people naturally search for identities, for communities, for some kind of anchor that grounds them in an ever-changing world. And there's nothing wrong with that in principle, right? But when the identities and the communities people find are virtual and toxic and regressive, then you have a problem. And that's kind of where we are at the moment.
That's exactly right. So one of the great insights that I think I gained in doing the research came out of a conversation I had with Tony Blair, who's very thoughtful about these kinds of issues. When human beings feel deeply anxious and unmoored, they tend not to move left economically, they tend to move right culturally. In other words, when you feel like the ground is shifting under you, your instinct is not immediately to say, I need more government programs, I need more assistance, I need more worker retraining. No, it's to say, bring me back to the world I was in, that I was comfortable in, that I was familiar with. And that feeling tends to drive you culturally to the right to say, why are all these new people coming into this world? Why do we have this free trade that allows people to take my factory and relocate it to South Korea? That impulse is much, much stronger than the one that says, you know, I understand change is a factor of life. Can I just get a little bit more education? Can I get a little bit more retraining? And that dynamic is exactly what you're seeing, I think, everywhere in the world right now.
I have never thought of myself as a conservative, and I still don't because I'm not. But I will say that as I've gotten older, I've come to appreciate the instinct to preserve wisdom and tradition. And as you write in the book, the fundamental tension here is this pull between the past and the future. And in some sense, I guess they think of politics as the attempt to navigate that tension, the tension between the past and the future, which is really the tension between order and progress. And things go sideways when we lose that balance too far in one direction or the other. I mean, do you feel like we've basically lost that equilibrium today in ways that we can't recover from or would be very, very difficult to recover from?
I don't know that we can't recover from it, but you know, one of the great dynamics of the last 150 years, and it's easy to always not kind of look at these periods with nostalgia, but one of the productive dynamics that came out of the Industrial Revolution was that you had this seesaw between the past and the future, as you put it, with, you know, some people pushing for changes that were going to drive dynamism and innovation and economic progress and social progress, and other forces that were saying, slow down, this is too much change. Mm. So, you know, people often say capitalism won and communism lost in the 20th century, but that's not actually true. Capitalism and communism both lost in the 20th century. What won was social democracy. If you look at every advanced industrial society today, they all look like some version of what the social democratic parties of Sweden and Germany were advocating in 1900. They all have basic welfare states, rules about children can't work, number of hours, all the kinds of things that were considered wildly outlandish in 1900 are all in place. That's an example of, you know, the past and the present kind of ending up resolving in a very good place. I worry that we don't have that dynamic right now, because what you're seeing on the populist right is not that kind of traditional conservatism that says, how do we shape this change? How do we slow it down? It's just a kind of radical impulse to say, burn the house down. That feels more to me like the French Revolution, like the Jacobins. It feels like the rise of the kind of populism of the 20s and 30s. And I want to be careful not to make facile comparisons to fascism. But there were a lot of movements around that time, which were a kind of radical efforts to address people's sense of deep alienation. That was a common response that came out of it, but I would argue it was totally unproductive. You know, it's rage, not reason.
One of the things I find annoying about some of the discourse around something like Trumpism here, you know, it's the whole, is it racism or is it economic anxiety that's propelling it? And the truth seems so obviously to not fit that binary exactly. I mean, racism is always a background reality, but I don't think there are more racists in the country today than there were, say, 40 years ago. And I don't think racism alone explains Trumpism, nor does some pure argument about economic anxiety. I mean, I think fundamentally there are a lot of forces at work here. Reality is messy in that way. But at the core, a lot of it is this cultural disorientation and the anxiety that produces, and the fact that there is always a constellation of grifters and xenophobes and nativists and populists who respond to that reality and exploit it. And I think that is a familiar pattern in history. And I think we're dealing with it now, and it never leads to good places.
Yeah, I mean, I think you put it very well when you said it's sort of cultural anxiety. And that cultural anxiety is partly based on economics, partly based on immigration, partly based on information technology, which has upended the old structures of the economy. There's something very real about it that people shouldn't be too facile in saying it's racism. And my best example of this, just a couple of days ago, I saw on Twitter, I refuse to call it X, Richard Dawkins explaining how, as one of the world's most celebrated atheists, he loves the fact that he lives in a Christian country that is deeply influenced by Christian culture, loves the world of Britain with its parish churches, with its hymns, with its Christmas holidays, and would hate to live in a Britain that lost that, and certainly not one that was replaced by mosques and Islam. Now, for somebody who's an atheist, that seems to me puzzling, you know, because it's totally irrational. What he's really talking about there is the cultural anxiety of giving up something he had grown up with. It's difficult to argue, since he believes these are all essentially hocus-pocus fairy tales. Why would it matter if you replaced one hocus-pocus fairy tale with another? What he's saying is that, in a sense, his country has been so deeply shaped by the hundreds and hundreds of years of Christianity that he is deeply attached in a kind of irrational level And would hate to see a change. And I totally get that. So imagine if somebody like Dawkins feels that way. Imagine how a believing Christian would feel.
After one more short break, Fareed tells us about the modern global revolution and what it means for the future. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
So if we're living through this revolutionary period, and all that means is that a lot is changing, and we don't know what is on the other side of that change, what do you think the stakes are right now? What do we stand to gain? What do we stand to lose?
I think the stakes are really liberal democracy, because what has happened is the people who are at this point displaced, anxious, angry, radicalized, the focus of their ire, their attention, is basically to tear down the system, you know, the world that produced all this. And the one place where they can focus, you can't uninvent AI. You can't even really undo globalization, because it's so broad and it's so interpenetrating. I mean, you can decrease it a little bit, but how would you, for example, stop globalization of digital goods, which are increasingly the most important goods, right? Like if you go to your doctor and he takes an x-ray, and then for reasons of cost and efficiency, he sends the x-ray to somebody in India to analyze, a radiologist, at half the price. How could you stop that? Would you have a law saying you can't send emails with attachments to people in India? You know, so it's not a target-rich environment, but politics is. And so the tendency to just utterly disrupt and screw up liberal democracy and make it thoroughly illiberal, which is happening in lots of places, not just the United States. It's interesting to see whether or not it will be possible to keep it going, because my worry is that one act of illiberalism begets another. So take the country I grew up in, India. So one of my big fears is Modi, very charismatic, very powerful, quite a liberal prime minister of India, has dismantled a lot of things like the independence of bureaucracies, the independence of the judiciary. You know, he uses the tax authority routinely to kind of weaponize it against his enemies. If and when he ever loses an election and the next party comes into power, won't they say, hey, these were very nifty tools to have at our disposal? Why should we go back to the old liberal constitutional restraints, where we, you know, observe the independence of the judiciary and the independence of bureaucracies and stuff like that? You can see this happening even in the U.S. with something like the filibuster, or, you know, when Trump weaponizes the judiciary. I would say there has been a bit of a tendency on the liberal side also to weaponize the judiciary. Many of these cases against Trump would never be brought against him were he not Donald Trump. I mean, would somebody have brought up a real estate accounting fraud case from 20 years ago, which no prosecutor had ever thought to prosecute? That's the kind of thing I worry about, where the whole system is getting more illiberal.
If the liberal era does die out, that this historical run that liberal democracy has been on since the Netherlands, I guess, in the 16th century, more or less, do you think it will be because liberalism devoured itself, because it unleashed too much innovation and growth and change and cultural disorientation, that it actually sort of swallowed itself and created too much instability and imploded for that reason?
You know, that's a very smart way of putting it. I wish I had thought of that and put it in the book quite that way. Yeah, but yeah, that's exactly right, that it produced so much accelerating change. And then it turned out we did not, as human beings, have the capacity to navigate through that level of change wisely. We gave in to our fears and our emotions, and we didn't find a way to kind of create some anchors, some ballasts that allowed us to kind of move through these times. I am ultimately not that pessimistic because I think that we've been through backlashes before. I mean, some of them are pretty huge. You know, one of the biggest eras of change in the Industrial Revolution was really the Second Industrial Revolution, kind of 1880 to 1920. Basically, electricity, most centrally, but also cars, telegram, trains, movies, all that. And look at the disorientation it produced and the backlash it produced. You know, we got out of that communism, fascism, world wars, the collapse of three of the greatest empires in the world in World War I. So, you know, we have been there before, and liberalism does find a way to revive itself, partly because I think at the end of the day, human beings want to be free. They like progress. They want the fruits, at least, of liberalism. I do continue to hope that what we're talking about is a temporary setback, not a permanent reversal.
You wrote this famous essay about the rise of a liberal democracy, I think in 1997, almost 30 years ago. And I think it's one of the most important pieces written in the last several decades. And you were right, firstly, but you clearly had a sense of where the world was headed. I guess I'm going to ask you to do that thing you probably don't want me to ask you to do, which is to look into the future a little bit, but I'm going to do it anyway. What do you think it's going to look like in 30 years from now? Can you even imagine?
There is no one future out there, right? There are many possibilities depending on our actions. And while I do think there are big structural forces at work in the world, sometimes things, you know, a lot depends on a particular series of choices that we make. But I do think the trends that I worry about most are that we continue to see this rising illiberalism that then has the effect of creating, in a weird way, returning us back to some of the worst of the old, you know, the kind of elites who are corrupt, who run the country's economy and politics and society, but have now figured out a way to, you know, be populist autocrats, give the people enough bread and circus that they can survive. I see this particularly in the developing world, where I sometimes wonder, was the liberal progress we saw, the liberal democratic progress we saw in the developing world over the last 30, 40 years, largely a product of Western power and influence? That as that Western power and influence wanes, will we see an authentic nationalism that doesn't really care that much about checks and balances and constitutions and restraints? Are we seeing the same in India? Are we seeing the same in some parts of Latin America? You know, that will these countries find their own path to certain universal values that liberalism first came to? Individual rights, individual dignity, individual autonomy, the recognition that power has to be checked and balanced, the openness of the systems, or will all that atrophy?
And what does that mean, right? If they don't find their way to those values, where do they end up? I mean, this is the thing, right, about liberalism. It did succeed in delivering maximum freedom to lots and lots of people. But it turns out, and a lot of people anticipated this, if you give people too much freedom, if the cost of that freedom is chaos and disruption and too much change too quickly, what do? Well, they run into the hands of authoritarians who promise stability, who promise to make things the way they were. I mean, this is why Plato hated democracy, famously.
That's exactly it. Kierkegaard says anxiety is the dizziness of freedom.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The psychologist Eric Fromm talks about how human beings, you know, this was the title of his most famous book, human beings search for kind of an escape from freedom. That escape from freedom is such a wonderful way of describing it.
I hate even asking this because I roll my eyes every time I hear someone in the press repeat the cliche that this is the most important election of our lifetime. I mean, apparently every election is the most important of our lifetime, but here I go. do you think the stakes in November are really that high? I mean, because whatever one thinks of Trump, and I think anyone listening to the show knows what I think of Trump, it is just a fact that he does not believe in liberal democracy and seems quite willing to destroy it if it's convenient for him politically.
Yeah, I think one way to think about how serious this election is, you know, to go back to the Cold War and say to yourself, would it have really mattered that much if Adlai Stevenson or Dwight Eisenhower had won in 52? Would it have mattered that much if Kennedy or Nixon had won in 1960? These were very similar characters, slightly different foreign policies, largely similar domestic policies. You know, Nixon, when he became president, didn't dismantle a single one of the New Deal programs. In fact, expanded them. In fact, it proposed universal health care at one point. Well, we're in a very different place now because, as you say, Trump fundamentally doesn't believe in the system. And he represents people who are basically saying, burn the house down. And we've seen this. I mean, he is the only president in American history to have tried to thwart the peaceful transfer of power. And not just tried, in a sense, he succeeded. Forget the mobs outside. He succeeded in pressuring a majority of House Republicans to vote against the duly certified by 50 states election of Joe Biden. And even though I think 55 or 60 courts upheld that election, if the Republicans had been in a majority, Joe Biden's election would not have been certified. That strikes me as pretty historic. You know, that's not that doesn't happen every 4 years. So could Trump turn out to be less dangerous than that? It's possible, because this is not somebody who has a fully worked out worldview. He's representing people who want to burn the house down, and he wants power. And both those things happen to coincide with the idea, don't observe limits, don't observe norms, don't observe institutions. So that's why he's doing it. Maybe he'll change, but it seems like a pretty huge gamble to take.
You started the book talking about the difference between the scientific definition of revolution, going in a circle, ending up where you began, and political revolution of overthrow. But are they really that different in the end, as you were implying? Are we just going to end up in the same place? And will liberalism in the end look like the historical blip that maybe it is?
I hope not. You do see this movement of progress and backlash. But at the end of the day, you do make progress. You do move forward. Think about the number of democracies around the world. Yes, in the last 10 years, you have seen significant reversal and significant decay within democracies. But if you ask yourself, where are we compared to 1970? Well, you have a lot more democracies. You have a lot more liberal democracies than you had. You look at places like Taiwan and South Korea, which are considerably more liberal and democratic than they were. You look at, you know, Latin America. You can even see in Africa, countries like Kenya and Ghana, you know, and so you have to keep that longer perspective in mind and say, yeah, we're going to have setbacks. The real challenge is, what do you do during the setbacks? How best do you fight? How best do you navigate? And one of the things I think, and I urge liberals, and I mean liberals broadly, you want to fight, but you don't want to overreach. You don't want to push so much change down a society that it can't take it. And I think sometimes on issues like immigration and multiculturalism and sort of the so-called woke agenda and transgender rights and things like that, liberals don't recognize how much change they are pushing for, and that societies can only take so much change so fast, and that you need to persuade people, not decree these things from on high. If you find a way to navigate this period, I think we will be able to get through it. And maybe 20, 30, 40 years from now, we won't say liberalism was a blip. We'll say it generated enormous opposition and turmoil, but we managed to get through to a better place.
Once again, the book is called Age of Revolutions. Fareed Zakaria, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Sean, another great conversation. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right. As always, you know, I want to hear from you. Would you make a Fareed's argument? I think he's mostly right, but there is some part of me that wonders if we're just being Chicken Littles here. If maybe this period of change is not all that different from previous periods of change, we're just in the middle of it, and so it seems more dramatic than it really is. I don't think that's the case, but I could be wrong too. If you have any thoughts, send them my way. You can drop us a line at thegrayarea@vox.com. I read the emails and I try to respond to all of them, so keep them coming. And if you don't want to do that, just do me a solid, rate, review, subscribe, all that stuff. This episode was produced by John Ahrens, edited by Jorge Just, engineered by Patrick Boyd, and Alex Overington wrote our theme music. New episodes of The Gray Area drop on Mondays. Listen and subscribe. The Gray Area is part of Vox, which doesn't have a paywall. Help us keep Vox free by going to vox.com/give. Support for this show comes from NetSuite. All too often, people like the owl monkey and the Australian sea lion only see the world in black or white. Now, regular listeners of this podcast, who are mostly humans, understand that the world is more complicated than that. There's also plenty of gray areas. The world of business is a great example. See what I did there? An S&P 500 company and a small business owner have to see things differently, which is why NetSuite wants to provide products and services tailor-made for any business. NetSuite is a top-rated cloud financial system that brings accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into a single platform. NetSuite lives in the cloud, which can reduce IT cost and can improve efficiency and cut back on mistakes by bringing all your major business processes into one platform. NetSuite says that more than 37,000 companies have already made the move. Maybe it's time you did the same. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. You can head to netsuite.com/grayarea. NetSuite.com/grayarea. NetSuite.com/grayarea.